Welcome to the Science Podcast for December 14th, 2012. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. This week, spatial learning with help from pheromones, counting insects in a forest, and making smarter rocks.
The smartest rocks can measure accelerations really fast, so perhaps 512 times per second. Not so smart rocks record orientation of the rock every 15 minutes.
Plus, a few stories from our online daily news site.
Support for the Science Podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org. This podcast is also sponsored by Audible.com, home to over 100,000 audiobooks.
The female lifts her nose to the air. "Now here's someone I've smelled before," she murmurs quietly to herself, as the suddenly attractive male makes his way across the room. If human love lives worked the same way as those of mice, that might be a typical opening for a romance novel, since male mice use pheromones to mark territory and make themselves memorable to potential mates. I spoke with Jane Hurst about her research into spatial learning and pheromones and how the important protein Darcin got its name.
Scent marking is when animals deliberately deposit scents in their environment so that they can leave signals to communicate with other animals even when they're not there. So scent marking is a very useful means of communication, and it's used by a very wide range of animals, from the scent trails which are laid by foraging insects such as ants to lead others to the food source, to the territorial scent marks used very widely by mammals, from mice through to rhinos. The scents produced by mammals in particular can encode a large amount of information about the owner, including their species, sex, and individual identity, as well as information about the animal's current status.
You focused in on mice in your study. What do mice in particular use scent markings for?
So all mice use scent marks to advertise information about themselves and their location. But adult males invest very heavily in urine scent marks to advertise their ability to defend a scent mark territory successfully, both to females and, of course, to rival males. As only males that are successfully defending a territory can actually ensure their marks predominate in that area, it's an honest signal to females about who the owner of the territory is and where to find him. And it's only these dominant territory owners that females select as high-quality mates.
Okay. Well, you studied a component of these scents called Darcin, a protein component. Why did you focus on that element in particular?
Well, female mice will show an instinctive attraction to spend time near the urine of adult males, which we knew. And so in an earlier study, we wanted to find out what the molecules were in the male urine that stimulates this instinctive attraction. And although males produce a large number of pheromones in their urine that are under androgen control, so they're only produced by adult males, we found that actually only one of these sex pheromones is instinctively attractive to females. And this is a small and volatile protein that females can only detect when they directly contact the urine with their noses. And because of its special role in stimulating female attraction, we called this protein Darcin, after Mr. Darcy, Jane Austen's romantic hero in Pride and Prejudice. But Darcin is actually involatile, so they can't detect this pheromone at a distance from the scent mark. And so we were intrigued to know how males use an involatile pheromone to actually attract females. Because we usually think of scents as something that you can detect from a distance, and then animals have to actually track the scent to its source. But actually, animals might also remember the location of a highly attractive cue, such as this sex pheromone. So we wanted to investigate whether females remember the location of attractive male scents and whether this learning and memory is specifically induced by this pheromone Darcin.
So how did you set up your experiment?
So we tested this spatial learning in a very simple setup where mice were given two identical dishes in a clean arena. We then gave them one or more daily learning sessions where a scent stimulus was just put in one of the two dishes for just 10 minutes. And then to test if they had learned a preference for the location of the scent stimulus, we tested them again 24 hours or even more later in a clean arena with two clean dishes to see if they continued to show a preference for the location where they'd previously encountered the pheromone or indeed other components of male scent.
And so what did you find out? What effect does the scent stimulus have on the mice?
So females showed a strong preference for spending time in a dish that contained the male pheromone Darcin. And after only a single learning session, they had learned a preference for this location, even when the scent wasn't any longer present. So this attraction to the remembered location of the pheromone was just as strong as the attraction they'd shown when the actual scent was there in the dish. But if the male urine in the dish contained no garcin, they failed to show any remembered preference for the urine location. And if we just put the garcin in the dish on its own, again, they'd show this remembered preference for that particular location. So it's a very specific response to this one protein. However, if they returned to the site when there was no garcin present, this remembered attraction to a location extinguished rapidly on repeated testing, showing that actually the mice continually updated their sort of spatial map of where this attractive pheromone was.
So, as you mentioned, there are volatile and this non-volatile component of a scent. How are these two parts working differently?
So the volatile components in an unfamiliar scent are very important for drawing attention to a scent mark. And it's these volatile components that actually stimulate animals to approach and contact the scent, where they can then detect in volatile pheromones like garcin. But however, it's the contact with garcin that then stimulates an instinctive attraction to spend time near the scent. And it's also this garcin that stimulates associative learning, so that animals now transfer the attraction that they were showing towards the pheromone itself, not only to the location of the scent, but also to volatile odors of the individual male that they've now associated with garcin. So now females will show a learned attraction both to the location of a male scent, so they will return to that same site, and they also show a learned attraction to the individual airborne odor of that particular male. So they are now attracted to other scent marks from that particular male and to the male himself. So this pheromone-induced learning reinforces attraction to one particular male much more effectively than simple attraction to the pheromone alone. One of the complications here is that males actually produce garcin in their own urine. However, when they encounter their own urine, they quickly recognize their own individual signature in the scent through volatile odors, and so they don't contact their own urine scent marks, and so they're not exposed to garcin in their own scent, and then they don't learn this attraction to the location of their own scent mark.
So what can we generalize more broadly about learning from this study?
Well, what it tells us is that pheromones can be highly potent stimuli for associative learning in relation to key social stimuli. Much like Pavlov's dogs learn to respond to a bell, which is associated with the appearance of a food reward, mice learn to respond to other cues that are associated with a highly attractive social stimulus, in this case a sex pheromone. But this pheromone actually stimulates learning of the associated cues on just a single exposure. So it's extremely rapid learning in response to these key social stimuli. So learning is also highly specific to this one pheromone. And that suggests that indeed there may be a specific learning pathway in the brain that is stimulated by this pheromone. So it might be a very special case of learning.
Can they only learn one kind of thing?
It appears from what we've looked at so far that they can learn different types of cues that they can associate with this pheromone. Mm-hmm. So they are learning spatial cues, which is what we've shown in this paper, but they will also learn the other odor cues which are associated with the pheromone. Mm-hmm. So when they encounter garcin in the urine of one particular male, they now learn an attraction to the other odor cues associated with that male. So they've now learned attraction to a particular male that they wouldn't have shown before.
What does garcin actually smell like? I know that the volatiles is what we actually smell.
Well, as far as we're concerned, garcin has no smell at all because it's a protein. And
right.
There is no evidence at all that humans can smell a protein. So we don't have the specific organ that is required to detect protein pheromones. So most mammals, other than humans and other catarrhine monkeys, they have an additional olfactory system called the vomeronasal system.
Mm-hmm.
And this system has specific receptors that respond either to specific pheromones, things which are used to communicate within the species, or they will also pick up particular molecules given off by other species which are of considerable biological relevance to them. And we know that the receptors are sensitive to different types of odor cue. So some of them are sensitive to volatile pheromones,
mm-hmm.
but others of them will detect proteins. And because, of course, we don't have that system, we don't actually know what a protein smells like.
If, you know, not all mammals have a vermonasal organ and are not susceptible to these protein-based pheromones, is this something that can be generalized?
Just because this particular pheromone is detected through the vomeronasal system doesn't mean to say this only applies to species with a vomeronasal organ. Mm-hmm. It just happens to be that this particular pheromone is detected through the vomeronasal system. But what it looks like is that there may be specific pathways in the brain that make pheromones particularly potent in inducing associative learning. And that, of course, could occur in any species. Mm-hmm. We just happen to know one example here of associative learning in the mouse, which involves protein pheromone. We know of one other example of associative learning induced by a pheromone, and that's in rabbit pups, where rabbit pups learn other odors associated with the mammary pheromone. And we don't think that that is detected through the vomeronasal system. So it's very likely that this could be a very general response that is seen across animals, and indeed could include humans.
Wow. All right. Well, Jane Hurst, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much.
Jane Hurst and colleagues write about the impact of pheromones on learning in a report this week.
Insects perform important ecosystem services like pollination, dissemination of small seeds, herbivory, even the first stages of decomposition. Counting bug species serves to record their amazing diversity and can help in preservation efforts. Edward Hermy spoke with Yves Basset about his group's arthropod count in roughly a half hectare of Panamanian tropical forest. He started with some of the difficulty researchers have had in counting up insects.
Well, there's different methods, which are all pretty different because arthropods are very diverse, and then they do different things. Like, say, if you would like to measure the diversity of butterflies and the diversity of ants, you won't be using the same methods. So in the past, what happened is that people have been sort of focusing only on butterflies, only on ants, because it's already rather difficult just to deal with one single group. So here, we use a range of methods. We actually covered most of those different arthropod groups who are doing different things in terms of ecological function. So in the past, we simply project the relation between the number of species of insects that you can find feeding on tropical plants. And there's been different methods, but this has been one of the most successful methods just to try to estimate this. But that didn't examine the number of species that you have of non-herbivore taxa. So there's always some imprecision into this.
So just to review, so you combined a bunch of different methods for measuring insect and arthropod diversity in tropical forests. And then with all of the data afterwards, you tried to find a model that would predict arthropod diversity based on plant biodiversity.
Correct. That's basically what we did. We had 14 different sampling protocols, so all targeting very different subset of the arthropods that you can find in this forest. And we applied this protocol from the soil to the upper canopies. Then after, we had 6 different competing models, and then we use those models to make prediction, but also we cross-check, we ground-truth this with different data that we had of survey were more complete for specific groups, and then we choose the best model.
So this model that you've developed comparing the diversity of arthropods to plants, what does it actually say? What is the prediction that you came up with?
Okay, so this is one of the 6 models, and it's pretty simple. Like, we collected 12 different sites, and then we look at the range of accumulation of the number of tree species that we had in those 12 sites, and then we also look at the accumulation of the species that we found in those 12 sites. That is, you know, we had so many species of arthropods for one site, and then it included so many species of tree species, and then we had a second site. And then we, of course, randomize this, and then we have a look at the number of tree species we have in 2 sites and the number of arthropod species, and then we make a cumulative curve, and then we fit the curve, and then we do this, of course, for all the different groups that we were studying.
So this is a very impressive sampling of a relatively small area of forest, but how can this study influence our understanding of global tropical diversity?
Yes, this is something which actually surprised us, is that the models were pretty good. I mean, What you have to realize is that one of the very first time that we could collect very well different arthropods, again, from the soil to the forest canopy. So the sampling was actually huge. So there was a huge effort in terms of, I think that in a small area that we collected was pretty well sampled.
Mm-hmm.
This is important because it's sort of grounding all the estimate with the area, with the number of trees and so on that we will use just then for the final estimation.
So how have your estimates of tropical arthropod diversity matched up with previous studies?
Well, nothing was really directly equivalent to this, but again, we could use some other studies where, for example, considering only ants, and then we had some data. We had also near complete inventory for some of the group in this forest. So we fitted the models, and then the model were actually very close to what we knew was the actual number of species that we had in this forest for only, I would say, a few of the models that were of the groups that were available to work with.
So what did you learn from this intensive sampling project?
Well, our aim was really just to work on the forest. So for this particular forest, which is 6,000 hectares, we think we have about 25,000 species of arthropods.
Mm-hmm.
But what was interesting is that if we looked at the best model we can predict this are the plant model. The plant model are also used with, of course, some slight differences to predict global estimate. What we found are the best estimate were very, very close to the plant model. So that means that you wouldn't need much correction to the global model according to our data. Of course, this is valid for one tropical forest here, and then we'll need more data of this kind just to validate the suggestion.
So was there any impact on the forest after collecting so many thousands of insects?
Yeah, this is a good question. I mean, we collected something like, during the course of the study, during 2 years, about 130,000 insect specimens, representing more than 6,000 species. But I don't think there is absolutely any impact. Every entomologist who use what we call mass trapping methods, who will be catching insects, who will be flying by, will easily catch, thousands and thousands of specimens over simply a week. And this is absolutely negligible because if you look at the number of insects who are flying in the forest, we're talking about, millions of individuals, and then this is absolutely negligible. There's been no supported study showing that any population of insects has been affected by those mass trapping methods. The only thing which might be a bit different is that if you start using specific baits to trap specific species, this is a bit different. In our case, we use that only for collecting bees, and then we know by experience that has a negligible effect on the population. It's really nothing.
Okay. Well, Yves Basset, thanks so much for talking with me.
Well, thanks for being interested in the arthropods of tropical rainforest, and this was a pleasure answering to your question.
Yves Basset and colleagues write about modeling insect diversity in a report in this week's issue.
This week's podcast is sponsored by Audible.com. Audible has over 100,000 audiobooks, including titles like Connectome, How the Brain's Wiring Makes Us Who We Are by Sebastian Sung, or books like The Great Animal Orchestra, Finding Origins of Music in the World's Wild Places by Bernie Krause. Right now, Audible is offering a free audiobook download of your choice, just for checking them out. When you sign up for a free trial at audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag, you get a free book and you support the Science Podcast. If you choose not to continue the trial, you can cancel and keep the audiobook. That address again is audiblepodcast.com/sciencemag.
We all know that rivers can be calm and rivers can be wild. If the differences are pronounced at the surface, imagine what a pebble or boulder skittering along with the undercurrents must experience. Using synthetic rocks implanted with monitoring technology, scientists may now be able to do more than imagine. I spoke with Science News writer Emily Underwood about these so-called smart rocks.
This story is about the trials and travails of these two researchers from the University of Texas who are trying to develop smart rocks.
Smart rocks are basically fake rocks made out of aluminum or concrete that can even be made out of plastic that contain instruments that can measure forces like acceleration and record every bump, roll, rest along the way as they travel downstream. They want to make smart rocks in order to figure out how rivers move sediment, but to look at it from a rock's point of view.
So this is all about smart rocks designed to sort of make measurements in the field. Mm-hmm. Can you give me some examples of some technologies that are out there right now?
Sure. So a rock that can measure forces along its journey down a river, there aren't many of them being used in the field. Most of what's been used in the field in the past are called tracers. And those are just objects like a marble or a magnet that's dropped in a stream and then found weeks, even years later. A smart rock contains, in this case, an accelerometer, a data logger, and a battery pack, and it can record forces along three axes at different rates. So the smartest rocks can measure accelerations really fast, so perhaps 512 times per second. A stupider rock, but still a smart rock, will be able to record a little slower. So in the case of the story I'm writing about, these not-so-smart rocks record orientation of the rock every 15 minutes.
Wow. So they're not just studying how far rocks travel and what direction, but really the complex interplay of forces sort of acting on them while they're traveling.
Yes, exactly. So what happens when a rock hits another rock? What happens when a rock rests in the riverbed? What does it take to pry a rock loose from its nest in the other rocks? Exactly.
So for those smart and not so smart rocks actually being deployed in real rivers, what have scientists and researchers been able to learn so far?
So far, not a whole lot, because the smartest of the smart rocks are pretty delicate. And in the case of the story I'm writing about, they didn't last very long. The rocks that lasted for months and recorded over a long period of time, measured forces every 15 minutes. Those rocks were able to tell researchers what happened every time the water levels changed. So every 15 minutes, they take measurements of the water levels, and you can sync those with the measurements of the orientation of the rock. So as the snowmelt comes down from the mountains in Idaho, they can tell how those different levels of water affect the rock's movements. I should note that there are other researchers who have deployed smart rocks in rivers in other places, but their studies have been pretty limited in size and scope.
So what would a smart rock look like? Would I be able to recognize it if I came across it in a stream?
It depends on where they deploy it. If they put a smart rock on land that's publicly accessible, they will not paint it. They will try to make it inconspicuous so that people don't pick them up. But most of the smart rocks that I wrote about are painted bright colors, so neon pink, yellow, green, or they're made out of metal, so they're shiny aluminum.
So how do researchers then detect these rocks after they've been washed away downstream, especially those that may not be readily detectable by the naked eye?
Right. Great question. This is where the drama comes in this story. In the case of the super smart aluminum smart rocks, the idea at first was to put a radio tag in them, similar to the ones that you use to track pets, re-identify merchandise, that kind of thing.
Like RFID tags?
Exactly, RFID tags. The problem is that RFID tags do not work well in close proximity to metal. So they actually ended up having to look for these aluminum smart rocks with metal detectors, walking down the stream with a metal detector. And the problem with that was that the creek itself is actually full of metallic objects which respond. So
like litter from humans.
Yeah, that's one of the sort of funny twists of the story, is it's not actually easy to recover these things at all.
But I'm sure they got a lot of pocket change.
Exactly. In the case of the not-so-smart, still-smart rocks made of concrete, those have RFID tags, and they can be tracked with an antenna and a data logger GPS backpack.
So why is it important to understand the flow of rocks and sediments in rivers?
So rivers move around 13 gigatons of sediment to the ocean every year. The only other force that moves anything like that much dirt, rocks, sand, mud is people, actually. Altogether, you know, that's how we get features like the Grand Canyon. That's how you create beaches and deltas. On the downside, that movement of sediment is also why our houses fill up with mud during a flood, why bridges get scoured around their foundations, why a dam might fail. So the engineers have a lot of stake in figuring out how this works.
But I know that we have a lot of models for this sort of motion. You know, I remember studying the differences between how silt-sized particles, sand-sized particles, and gravel, you know, respond to the different forces in rivers. Well, you know, is there anything wrong with what we currently know about the field? Where does the need for actual smart rocks come from?
Sure. So those models sometimes do a good job, but a lot of times they don't. And frequently those models are off by at least an order of magnitude.
Really?
And that's not because scientists aren't trying really hard. It's because what you put into the models requires careful measurements of things that are very hard to measure, especially hard to measure at the bottom of a river in the middle of a flood. So things like, how does a rock initially get dislodged from the riverbed? That's something that you sort of need to study it from the rock's perspective, and that's what these smart rocks are for.
Okay, so we've got smart rocks, we've got not-so-smart rocks. All of these have different lifetimes out in the wild, depending on their technologies. So where is this research headed? What's next?
Well, what comes next is, at least Joel Johnson, the lead researcher of the story that I focused on, he's going to try to develop aluminum smart rocks with more powerful batteries. That's his next step. Lindsay Alind, his PhD student, is going to continue to make more of the concrete rocks that sample every 15 minutes and sort of try to deploy them en masse. The more you've got out there, the more you're going to learn.
Great. Well, Emily Underwood, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Emily Underwood writes about building smarter rocks in a News Focus this week.
Finally today, David Grimm, online news editor for Science, is here to give us a rundown of some of the recent stories from our daily news site. So, David, first up, we have a new mechanism for a long-standing treatment. It's one of those things where we know it works, but we don't know how.
That long-standing treatment is maggots. Maggots have actually been used for centuries. Napoleon actually used them in his army to clean wounds. And the reason maggots have been so popular for so long is because they tend to eat rotting flesh and leave healthy tissue alone, meaning that if you want to clean out a wound, especially in the age before antibiotics, maggots were a great way to do that. And in fact, they become popular again recently because there's so much antibiotic resistance out there. And in fact, in 2004, the U.S. Food and Drug Administration actually approved maggot therapy as a prescription treatment.
So we know it works, but we don't know how it works.
We don't know how it works, right. So that's what this new study is about. And what the researchers did was they actually took maggot secretions from disinfected maggots, and they prepared these in the lab. And they added them to donated blood samples from four healthy adults. And the researchers measured the level of so-called complement proteins. And these are proteins that are involved in the body's inflammatory response, which would happen when you got injured, causes swelling. And what the researchers found was that every blood sample that was treated with a maggot secretion showed lower levels of complement proteins.
So the maggot juice was suppressing the immune molecules in the blood?
Exactly. And it was suppressing them by up to 99.9% in some cases. So it was a very powerful response. What was even more surprising was that these maggot secretions were really long-lasting. Even if the scientists treated the blood samples a day, a week, or a month afterwards, they still had the same effect. They also even boiled some of these maggot secretions, and they still didn't lose any of their potency. So these are really effective secretions at suppressing the immune system.
It sounds like it's a good candidate for a pill, too, instead of a maggot format.
Right. Well, that's the idea that the researchers hope that maybe the research could lead to a clinical drug that would feature maggot secretions, although that's probably several years away. Although if you don't want to wait for the pill, you can get those maggots right now, because they are FDA approved and you can get them via prescription.
Wow. All right. Next up, we have a story about why homosexuality may still be around, despite the fact that it might have some evolutionary disadvantages.
Right. Well, that's one of the big mysteries about homosexuality, because most homosexual people don't procreate. The question is why and how has homosexuality sort of persisted in our population? We usually think, at least from a Darwinian sense, that the genes that we pass on, the traits that we pass on are adaptive. They help us become fitter. They help us produce more offspring. And homosexuality would seem to go against that because, again, people that are homosexual tend not to have children. These researchers think they have come up with one viable explanation.
Right. And this isn't something that they've just seen in people, right? This exists in other organisms.
Right. This isn't a mystery just for humans. Homosexuality has been seen in swans, in sheep, and actually a variety of other animals. One thing researchers do know in humans is that homosexuality tends to run in families. If one of a set of identical twins is gay, there's a 20% chance that the other twin will be gay as well.
So what do the researchers look at? Do they look at the genes of the people?
Well, that's something that had been done in the past. You know, researchers have been looking for, you know, what they call a gay gene or gay genes. That would help sort of explain the mystery, because if there were gay genes, that could explain how it was passed down from generation to generation and why it seemed to run more in families. But in this study, the researchers didn't look at the genes themselves. They looked at modifications to the genes, something known as epigenetic changes. And these are chemical modifications that actually can turn certain genes on or off or modify how much of the gene is expressed in the cell, how much of the protein from that gene is made. And the researchers focused on a time when a lot of epigenetic changes are being made, namely during development in the womb. And they also looked at the interplay between hormones. Fetuses are exposed to a lot of hormones in the womb, and how that might interplay with epigenetic changes. So in the womb, both male and female fetuses are exposed to testosterone, but female fetuses have a way of sort of blunting the effects of testosterone, which otherwise would turn them male. It leads to the development of testes and ostensibly to the development of male sexuality. What the researchers propose is that there's epigenetic changes in the female and the male fetuses that sometimes make the female fetus much more sensitive to testosterone, for example, which would make this fetus have a much more male-type sexuality when this child was born. And that could explain what's happening in the womb. It could also explain why homosexuality could be passed down from generation to generation, because epigenetic changes can actually stick around on the DNA. They help sort of bind together the long strands of DNA, and that actually could mean that so-called epi marks could be passed from parents to offspring. Could be a way, even if there isn't a gay gene or gay genes, there may be these gay epi marks that are passed down through the generations. Mm.
And so do they know anything about how these marks might actually affect sexuality?
And Sarah, that's really the big question here, is exactly how this is working. And right now, researchers are sort of still at the hypothesis stage. They're sort of trying to come up with an explanation for why homosexuality has been evolutionarily conserved. They think they've got it, but now they've actually got to show that that's what's happening, and that's going to be the next step.
Right. All right. Next up, we have a story about elephants on the rampage.
Sarah, this story is about elephants, particularly Asian elephants in Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka only has about 6,000 elephants left, and elephants, especially Asian elephants, are a very endangered species. They're extinct in 78% of their historic range. And what's making matters worse is that even when researchers try to protect elephants by keeping them in national parks, the elephants often escape where they hurt themselves, and they actually also hurt other people. Each year, more than 70 people and 200 elephants die as the result of human elephant conflict. So it's not just that the elephants are disappearing, but there's just a really big problem with elephants living in such close proximity to humans and vice versa.
So it's really hard for a population to share space with elephants. What kinds of things have researchers done to tackle that?
You know, what they used to do, and it wasn't researchers necessarily, but when elephants used to escape, they used to get shot. And more recently, conservationists have argued that don't shoot the elephants, just put them back where they came from, and that will solve the problem. And this new study set out to figure out, does that actually solve the problem? And what it actually found is it actually can make the problem worse.
So we know not all elephants like to stay put. What did the researchers do to track things more closely?
Well, what a team of researchers did was they took 12 elephants. These were all elephants that were captured outside of their protective area. They darted the elephants with tranquilizers and fitted them with GPS collars so they could track their movements. And they tracked the movements of these 12 elephants over a period of up to 3 years. And what they found is only three of these elephants that had been returned to their protected areas actually stayed. The rest of them escaped again. Some of them tried to get back to where they were originally. Some of them tried to get back to where they had been found. Others just sort of really wandered far afield. For example, there was one elephant named Brigadier who left the very next day after he had been relocated, traveled almost 96 kilometers before reaching the sea. He then continued his journey, swimming another 5 kilometers, but was reported by the Navy and returned to shore. He settled in another region, continued to cause problems, and eventually fell into a well and died.
Wow.
And there was another elephant named Homie who set off for home 3 times after being relocated and died 15 months after his first move from multiple gunshot wounds. And these were pretty typical situations. The elephants that were being relocated really did not want to stay put, really did not want to be in the protected area, wanted to go somewhere else. And the problem is when they went somewhere else, they often entered major towns, caused a lot of destruction. They actually killed 5 people, and 5 of the elephants were themselves killed over the course of the study. So if anything, relocating the elephants actually made the problem worse.
So what conclusions can researchers and policymakers draw from the study?
Well, what the study shows is that relocation of elephants doesn't really work. Unfortunately, what that means is that conservationists have to come up with another strategy that's going to be both beneficial to humans and beneficial to elephants as well. And I'm sure that's something they're working on now.
Okay. Well, what else is on the site this week, David?
Well, Sarah, for Science Now, we've got a story about how a blood pressure drug may help treat autism. Also a story about the Hubble Space Telescope revealing new findings about the early universe. For Science Insider, our policy blog, we've got a story about a UK plan to sequence the entire genomes of 100,000 people. Also a story about one scientist's failed crusade to boost the amount of money the NIH has available to fund scientists. And finally, for Science Live, our weekly chat on the hottest topics in science, we've got our last Science Live of the year this week. It's about efforts to develop a male contraceptive, a male version of the pill. And Science Live will be taking a bit of a hiatus after that and returning on January 10th. Be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Sarah.
David Grimm is the editor for Science's online daily news site. You can check out the latest news and the policy blog, Science Insider, at news.sciencemag.org, where you can also join a live chat, Science Live, on the hottest science topics.
And that concludes the December 14th, 2012 edition of the Science Podcast.
If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org.
The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Carrie Klein.
And I'm Sarah Crespi. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS, thanks for joining us.